Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. The Trump administration's version of the Clean Power Plan was released this week, and many are skeptical it will actually help coal.
You know, it'll keep some of the plants on. I don't know as if it'll keep all of them on.
We'll also find out what Albany County is doing to better serve juvenile offenders and reduce costs.
Putting people in prison, that costs a lot of money, too. Like, it's taxpayers' dollars.
And we'll hear about an unlikely solution to drought in the West. The walking, talking ecosystem that is the beaver.
Just through their diligence and 24-hour work ethic, they're making amazing things happen in the streams.
And we'll look back at the Republican battle for governor. Those stories and more ahead on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. The Trump administration's rollback of coal plant regulations has renewed hope that some plants might stay open a little longer. The share of coal in the country's energy mix has dropped dramatically over the past decade. But even with industry-supported policy, there's concern this latest lifeline is not enough to stop that decline. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
In Gillette, Wyoming, on a bright, cloudless day, huge open pit mines dot the perimeter of a coal-fired power plant, the Dry Fork Station. Inside, turbines are producing electricity from pulverized coal mined a mile south. It's feeding electricity to the entire western grid right now.
California, Washington, Oregon, New Mexico, west to the ocean.
That's Tom Stolka, the plant manager here. He says the sun can stop shining, wind blowing, but coal, he says, is reliable.
Coal-fired power plants are a necessity to keep the system stable, the electricity grid stable in America.
Stolka believes the Obama-era Clean Power Plan could have put that at risk. It aimed to cut carbon emissions by shifting away from coal to renewables. That would have been a big blow to Wyoming, where the coal industry produces nearly a quarter of the state's income.
Yeah, so we're hoping, you know, this new plan under the Trump administration will relax that a little bit.
The new proposal, called the Affordable Clean Energy Rule, would give states more power to regulate carbon emissions. It doesn't set any cap for reducing them. It simply suggests how individual plants could become more efficient.
You know, it'll keep some of the plants on. I don't know as if it'll keep all of them on. But, yeah, I think it'll have an impact on which plants close and which plants stay running.
University of Wyoming economist Rob Godby is not so sure. He says the real problem for coal is economic. It's just too expensive compared to other forms of energy.
Coal-fired power plants have to compete directly with natural gas plants and renewables where they're already losing. And this plan really isn't going to affect that.
Godby says, sure, it's possible some plants could stay open longer. The proposal would allow coal plants to make minor emissions control changes without having to do a full bank-breaking environmental upgrade.
It maybe creates a little bit more of an incentive to invest in some coal-fired power plants to keep them open a little longer than they might have been otherwise. But that is a very small number.
According to S&P Global Market Intelligence, utilities plan to close about 36 coal units by 2020. And many say they don't expect that to change, despite the new proposal. Cloud Peak Energy, the country's third largest coal producer, welcomes the rollback. But spokesman Rick Kurtzinger says more could still be done to protect coal. He says the company would even like to see Congress step in
and develop comprehensive and cohesive energy legislation that gives long-term certainty to utilities to make the 20- and 30-year investments necessary for lasting, affordable, and reliable electricity.
Back at the Dry Fork Station, Gillette Mayor Louise Carter King says the administration's Affordable Clean Energy Rule is really just a short-term boost. Plus, everything could change again after the next presidential election.
You know, there's always that thought. You just don't know what the next administration will do. So it's that uncertainty that is tough on people and the industry.
utilities are mindful of that too, which is another reason why the Trump administration's latest effort to help coal may not change much. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Some Western lawmakers are up in arms over a Trump administration announcement that eases the requirements for drilling near sage-grouse. Correspondent Matt Laszlo reports from Washington that Wyoming lawmakers say the state is not impacted by the announcement, though that could change.
There used to be millions of sage-grouse out west, but now the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service estimates there are only between 200,000 and 500,000 of the pudgy feathered birds. About 40% of them live in Wyoming, and while their population still fluctuates, the state's leaders have been praised for showing steady repopulation rates, according to Wyoming Senator Mike Enzi.
That's kind of the Western approach, you know, we'll do it ourselves.
The Obama administration had planned to list sage-grouse as an endangered species back in 2010, but eventually worked out a plan with everyone from the states to the oil and gas companies that kept them off the list. But now the Trump administration has removed what some officials say was a key plank of that plan, requiring, say, an oil company to create a similar habitat for the birds off-site if they're going to drill near their habitat. Enzi says he thinks Wyoming will be fine under the plan.
I checked first to see how that was going to affect Wyoming, and it should not affect Wyoming.
But it's not just Wyoming. Sage-grouse habitat stretches across 11 states in the West and two provinces in Canada. Montana Democratic Senator John Tester says the agreements reached between property owners and state and local governments has worked, so he doesn't understand why the Trump administration is trying to upend it.
To upend that makes no sense whatsoever, because it offered a solution to the problem so they wouldn't get listed, and now I'm concerned that they might.
Tester and other officials out west, including the Republican governors of Utah and Nevada, fear the new plan for the bird may eventually force the next administration to list it as endangered.
That's not a good thing. Keeping them off the endangered species list is the best possible avenue.
It's a similar fear up in Oregon, where Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley says he's also scratching his head after the administration's announcement easing rules that many private companies were fine with.
Because Oregon has had a very cooperative process in an effort to make sure the sage-grouse doesn't end up in a situation becomes an endangered species. And so anything that kind of disrupts that cooperation and the programs we have in place would be counterproductive.
And even Wyoming's neighbor, Colorado, has protested the new rule vigorously. Colorado Democratic Senator Michael Bennett says he's still hoping the broad coalition of opponents can convince the administration to reverse its course.
I mean, I think that we can hopefully let them understand just how broad the coalition is of people who put together the rule to begin with.
But Wyoming lawmakers aren't going to be signing those letters of protest. If anything, officials like Senator John Barrasso are now lobbying other Western states to follow Wyoming's plan for rehabilitating sage-grouse.
Wyoming is sort of ground zero, so Wyoming is really taking a leadership role on this, and then Governor Meade, when he was chairman of the Western Governors Association and the chairman of the Endangered Species Task Force with the Western Governors Association, I think has worked really well and collaboratively in a bipartisan way to make sure we can get through this in ways that can actually lead to recovery of species and avoid the need for a listing.
Senator Enzi agrees.
If the rest of the nation would follow Wyoming, the sage-grouse would not be endangered.
Even so, Enzi recognizes there are hurdles facing Western states when it comes to rehabilitating sage-grouse.
But the difficulty is that takes some time because legislatures, some of them don't meet every year. And when they do meet, they meet for short periods of time. So that makes it a little difficult to get through some of these different areas that are pretty sensitive.
All parties in this battle seem to want the same thing, to avoid an endangered species listing of sage-grouse at all costs. But opponents fear relaxing the federal requirements will actually backfire and force the next administration to list the bird, the very outcome most everyone in this battle wants to avoid. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
When we return, we'll bring you stories about the future of the Colorado River and a mysterious missing mammoth. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. 40 million people rely on the Colorado River for their water. Many of those who watch the river closely say it's tapped out, citing a possible shortage in less than 2 years. But not everyone agrees with that assessment. And a few loud voices say there are still places in the watershed to dam and divert. As Luke Runyon reports, that difference of opinion has big implications for water development in the West.
So yeah, Luke, you can see we spent...
Aaron Millian is a developer, and his name is synonymous with a water pipeline he's been pushing for almost a decade. He's sporting a cowboy hat and belt buckle when I meet him at a Fort Collins, Colorado coffee shop. He unfurls a map and points out the features of his latest proposal.
It's about a 3,800-foot drop, so we've got about...
With his finger, Millian traces the route of his pipeline. It would start in Utah on the Green River, then snake across Wyoming before dropping down into Colorado's populated Front Range. Millian says it would cost about $1 billion to build.
It's a bigger project, but they get done every day. I mean, we built a transcontinental railroad last I remember.
His plan takes advantage of a historical fluke. The 1922 Colorado River Compact, which divvies up the water, was written when the river was flowing at a record high. Now, though, for the past 18 years, high temperatures, drought, and overuse have sapped the river's flow.
People say there's no water left in the system. Well, when California has drained and Nevada and Arizona have drained the river and then cry foul because Lake Powell and Mead are low, again, I'll reiterate, had they not drained their, overtaken their share, they'd be full by 4 or 5x. Those are the facts. You can run the numbers.
This river is already reeling. It's nearly close to death from 1,000 cuts.
Nick Scow is conservation director with the Utah Rivers Council. The Salt Lake City-based environmental group is one of many filing protests against Millian's pipeline proposal.
And these big new diversions could be the straw that breaks the camel's back.
For Scow, the idea that there's a surplus of water in the Colorado River watershed is laughable. He says the river's two main reservoirs are dropping, and the river itself hasn't reached the Pacific Ocean in years.
There's this disconnect between, you know, what water rights states are entitled to on paper via the Colorado River Compact and what water is actually in the system.
Let's break that down. What Scow is talking about is this concept of paper water. On these agreements among states, there's a certain amount of water that exists on paper. But that doesn't always match up with so-called wet water, or what exists in reality. Some states have met the limit of their paper water from the Colorado River. Others haven't. And there's a growing recognition that water managers should think of the watershed and manage it as a whole, rather than a disconnected series of tributaries.
The Colorado River system is at risk of crashing Lake Mead or crashing Lake Powell.
That's Ann Castle. She's a former official with the Department of the Interior and now with the University of Colorado in Boulder.
Meaning that all the water gets used and the elevations drop so low that you can't force water through the system anymore.
Castle says Aaron Millian's pipeline increases the chance of those reservoirs dipping even further. But he's not the only person or agency suggesting we take more water from the Colorado River and its tributaries. Two water agencies on Colorado's Front Range are finalizing projects that would do just that. So too would a proposed pipeline in southern Utah. When it comes to river politics, Castle says everyone's fates are intertwined. That argument doesn't sway Aaron Millian, who says Western water law is on his side.
But people think that, you know, California, Nevada, and Arizona can stop this project, or that the governor in Wyoming can. That's just simply not true.
But water rights along the Colorado River are far from simple. So I asked Millian what the odds are that his pipeline will ever be built. He says he doesn't believe in absolutes and gives himself a 92% chance of coming out on top. I'm Luke Runyon.
This story is part of ongoing coverage of the Colorado River, produced in partnership with public media station KUNC in northern Colorado, with financial support by the Walton Family Foundation. Thank you.
Archaeologists at the University of Wyoming are putting out a call for help looking for a lost mammoth. How do you lose a 6-ton extinct animal that lived 13,000 years ago? Well, you find a few of its bones, but then lose track over the decades of exactly where they were found. But now some clues have come to the surface. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards sat down with the University of Wyoming anthropology professor Todd Surivel, the detective trying to put those clues together. His story starts on a drizzly day when field work on a dig near Douglas just wasn't going to happen.
Arrived. It was raining and it wasn't a good time to set up camp, so we decided to take the students to the Pioneer Museum in town. It was my first visit to that museum, and in the museum, in one of the cases, they had some mammoth bones, a couple of front limb bones, the jaw or the mandible, and a couple of other teeth. And I was really intrigued. I mean, one, I love mammoths. I'm fascinated by them. And two, the first people in the New World, the people who I study, people who lived here at the end of the last ice age, hunted mammoths. So any mammoth that's found is not only an interest to paleontologists, but it's potentially of interest to archaeologists. In the display case, there was some signage that was interesting. It said the bones were donated by William Eastman. It said that the bones are found on Bedtick Creek. And it said that they were discovered by Dr. Bird from the American Museum of Natural History.
But then the Pioneer Museum found a letter in their archives from this other guy, an L.C. Bishop, claiming that he had found the bones 20 years earlier, back in 1938.
The signage in the display case didn't make sense. At least we didn't know what the Dr. Bird reference was. We knew there's a famous archaeologist who had worked at the American Museum at the time, named Junius Bird. So we reached out to them to ask if Junius Bird had ever been in Wyoming and excavated a mammoth. And actually they got back to us and gave us some documentation from 1938. And it was actually Junius Bird's brother, R.T. Bird, who came through the area and apparently looked at the site and decided that the rest of the mammoth had eroded away. That's not what Bishop said in his letter in 1958. He said that after they pulled out those bones, they caved over the bank to preserve it so it could be excavated later by professionals. And he said at the time there were several feet of vertebrae sticking out of the bank. So from what we can tell, the site sat from the 30s until the 50s. But the only other information we have about anybody going to the site was that the new director of the Pioneer Museum found a small brown paper bag with three bone fragments in it, and typed on that bag is a message saying that Bishop went out there with two companions named Vetter and Hildebrand in July of 1958 and removed a few bones. I assume they're going out to check on it to see if it was still there. Those bones were in the bag. And as far as we know, that's the last time anybody's actually went out to the site. Now, one question we have is the mammoth still there, right? It's certainly possible that they excavated the entire mammoth at the time, but if they did, where would it be? All we have are these three small bone fragments left in that bag. Another possibility is that erosion has since removed the animal.
Did in any of the places that where you were getting some of these letters and things, did anybody ever give any directions for where the place is approximately?
Yeah, actually, we have a number of clues which are really interesting.
Clue number one. The sign in the museum that says it's near Bedtick Creek, a tributary of the North Platte near Douglas. But clue number two, in Bishop's letter, he also says he owned the land where he found the bones, and that it was in a cut bank near a distinctive rocky ridge.
It helps us to narrow down our options from somewhere in Wyoming to a very specific area. Except it's not that simple, of course, because the first thing we noticed was that the section that Bishop noted in his letter, he never actually owned. So there's a direct contradiction there. We wonder if Bishop made an error in describing the location of it and describing the section, but that would be unusual because he was the county surveyor. He knew his way around. So this summer, with the blessings of the landowners who have been absolutely wonderful in this process, we went out and we started poking around in this draw, mostly doing something called augering, which means drilling holes down through the sediments to look at the stratigraphy, to try to figure out where we have sediments of the right age. Now, we know the age of the mammoth because we radiocarbon dated it. So when we went out this summer, we were trying to identify areas along that draw that have sediments of that age. And there are several stretches along that draw where we think we found sediments of the right age, but we won't know until we get radiocarbon dates.
So now Surivel says they've hit a dead end.
You know, Wyoming is a small community and a big social network. I feel like everybody knows everybody, at least at arm's length, you know. In particular, if your last name is Eastman or Bishop or Vetter or Hildebrand, and you know about a mammoth that was found south of Douglas in the late 1930s, or if you went to visit the site in 1958 and you have any memories whatsoever about that mammoth, the location it was found, anything at all, it would be useful. In archaeology, a lot of the most important sites aren't found by archaeologists. They're found by local people, ranchers, hunters, hikers, people who are out on the land. Nowadays, it's in vogue, this idea of crowdsourcing scientific problems, but archaeologists have been doing this forever. Many of the most important sites, archaeological sites in Wyoming, weren't found by archaeologists, but were found by members of the public, and by working together, I think, we can accomplish a lot more than simply professionals working alone.
That was UW anthropology professor Todd Surivel. We have photos and drone images of the area where they believe the bones must be, if that would help jog your memory. Find them at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. There you can also find Dr. Surivel's contact information. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Next on Open Spaces, we'll update you on how the Republican primary race for governor played out in Wyoming. This is Open Spaces.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Back.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. State Treasurer Mark Gordon won the Wyoming Republican primary election by 7% of the vote. Some in the GOP who favored other candidates want to blame that on the possibility that Gordon attracted some Democrats who switched party affiliation the day of the primary. The other theory was that the large number of more conservative candidates split votes, which allowed Gordon to win. However, there's also the chance that Gordon, who came in as the favorite, was the preferred candidate. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck has more.
Mark's experience was helpful to him.
That's Gordon's campaign manager, Gail Geringer, who's overseen four gubernatorial races in her career. Geringer has also managed races for the U.S. Senate, U.S. House, and even the state legislature. She says when she runs a congressional campaign, you focus on ideology. When it's a race for governor, you want something different.
A governor is usually selected more as your best ambassador, the best representative, who also shares your philosophy, but it's not total ideologue.
Geringer says with Wyoming's financial situation, this year's Republican voters wanted to know how the candidates would handle things.
Spending in state government was the top topic always. Where we go with education, how we handle that issue, funding-wise, probably the subset of that.
And candidates backed that up with their campaign that focused on budget cuts, no new taxes, and how they would handle education. But there was also a view among Gordon's opponents that he was not quite as conservative as they were, and a couple tried to exploit it with negative ads or attacks during debates. Others just tried to point out their long-standing conservative nature. Darren Smith was the campaign manager of Foster Freeze. He says their research shows that Wyoming people want a conservative governor.
You look at the polling, and I would say that the conservatives outnumber the liberal moderate probably 2-1 in the Republican Party in Wyoming.
Foster Freeze was a Jackson millionaire who worked very hard to run a positive campaign and used advertising to tout his conservative approach. Smith says as voters got to know him, interest in him grew.
We found that his demographic was the working man and woman. They liked him because he liked them, and he always said, I'm one of the little guys, and I hit it big, but man, I want others to hit it big, too.
Smith says his conservative message connected with Wyoming voters. Brian Harnish is a senior research scientist at the Wyoming Survey and Analysis Center, known as WISAC. They conducted two polls on the Republican primary, one in June and one the weekend before the election. Harnish says in June, over half of those contacted knew Freeze, but at the time, most didn't like him.
He actually had a higher unfavorability rating at the time of those that knew his name. Since that point, there was a lot of campaign materials that went out, and Freeze really campaigned really hard leading up to the election day, and we saw what I think is a lot more people become aware of him as a candidate and what he stood for.
Freeze polled to within 6 points of Mark Gordon, and Harnish proudly says that their poll only missed the final outcome by 1 percentage point, as Gordon won by 7 points. In Wyoming, voters can register the day of the election, and they can change party affiliation, too. That's become a topic of conversation, and Freeze believes that cost him the election, believing that Democrats switched over and voted for Gordon. His campaign manager, Darren Smith, says Gordon certainly benefited as the candidate who was not as conservative as others.
Well, sure it did. I mean, because, you know, he was driving in a lane maybe with more votes. And then, you know, you have the open primary certainly played into that lane's favor.
The Freeze campaign has asked other candidates to help support an effort that will keep that from happening in the future. But researcher Brian Harnish is not sure that's exactly what happened. WISAC's polling always focused on Republican voters. And when you look at the numbers from June until August, Gordon certainly had support.
He gained 10% of the voters that had previously said they were voting for Freeze. And he also gained 15% of the voters that had previously said they were going to vote for Hageman. But what those shifts show us was that the people who ultimately ended up voting for Gordon came from, you know, all different backgrounds, people that had previously backed Freeze and people that had previously backed Hageman.
And those votes came from some of the other candidates as well. For his part, Gordon says since he was a familiar candidate, people preferred him. He also says he has the best vision for Wyoming. Democrat Mary Throne disagrees and plans to prove that in the next couple of months. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Earlier this summer, the Governor's Advisory Council on Juvenile Justice gave Albany County the Neil D. Madsen Award for its groundbreaking work with juvenile offenders. Since 2014, Albany County has reduced the number of young people who end up in secure detention by 34%. Advocates say that's good for kids and the state's bottom line. Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson takes a look at what's going right.
When you hear about people making bad decisions and going down a negative path, it like mostly happens in the teenage years.
Shelly's an expert of sorts on effective intervention with juvenile offenders.
So like if you reach out to someone who got in trouble in their teenage years, I feel like they're more likely to realize what they're doing wrong before it could lead to like long-time incarceration in state facilities.
Shelly knows what works because
She's been there. She's a minor, so I'm using an alias to protect her privacy. By the age of 15, she'd already had several interactions with law enforcement, from possession of tobacco to fighting in public to vandalism. But smoking, fighting, and graffiti were all things she grew up watching family and friends do. It wasn't until she ended up in Albany County's diversion program that she started to see a different future for herself.
So on the calendar, like, of course, I have the community service.
Putting hours in at the senior center or the soup kitchen isn't a new practice for kids who get in trouble with the law. But the diversion program run by Big Brothers Big Sisters in Laramie also includes fun and enriching activities like mountain biking, creative writing, and college visits.
I guess that's to show you that there's like more to Little Laramie, Wyoming than getting in trouble.
Instead of going through a court proceeding and ending up in a juvenile detention facility, Shelley went through Albany County's Single Point of Entry program. A team of people from the county prosecutor to school staff to the Department of Family Services worked together to figure out what would help her get on a positive course. Depending on the offense and the risk factors in a kid's life, the team could recommend community service and mentoring and tutoring through Big Brothers Big Sisters, as well as mental health or substance abuse counseling. The team also tries to root out underlying causes of bad behavior like abuse and neglect and can offer support to families. The big goal is to work as a team to give kids the support they need to stay out of the school-to-prison pipeline.
When I first took office in 2014, I had an opportunity to look at our crime statistics and reports from the age group of 18 to 25.
That's Albany County Attorney Peggy Trent. She says those rates were high.
So what that showed to me is that we needed to intervene sooner in these individuals' lives prior to them turning 18. And I'm happy to say as of this date, we have done that.
According to state statute, it's up to county attorneys to determine how they want to handle juvenile offenders. In 15 of Wyoming's 23 counties, juvenile service boards work with prosecutors to implement alternatives to out-of-home placements and detention.
However, the state hasn't figured out a system to save resources and to incentivize it to other communities.
But she is motivated to figure out how to make this work. Trent says that every year she pieces funding together and applies for grants to support the program. That's a headache she's willing to deal with because she knows it works. She says adequate and steady funding from the state would encourage more county attorneys to do what she's doing. Shelley points out that by investing in her now, the state could save money in the long run.
Putting people in prison like costs a lot of money too. Like, it's taxpayers' dollars, and I feel like if people like knew what like programs like this could do, like it would be such like a big thing. Like, it would be everywhere.
One of the first things County Attorney Trent did was engage the school district, because school is a place where kids spend a lot of time. Albany County School District Director of Special Services Steve Slyman says kids bring whatever they're dealing with at home, whether it's poverty, hunger, abuse, or mental health issues, with them wherever they go.
These kids are dealing with trauma all day long. Why wouldn't we try to intervene and help them get through some of that during the school day?
Slyman is the school district representative on the Single Point of Entry team.
Most outside counselors see kids, you know, once a week. We have counselors and school psychologists and nurses and teachers and paraprofessionals and principals. And we have people that know these kids every single day and interact with them all day long. Why shouldn't we be better informed about how to meet their needs on a daily basis?
All people deserve to have a good life. And if, like, the so-called bad kids, people think they don't need help, then like they're wrong, because everybody deserves a chance at a good life.
That's Laurel, a friend of Shelley's from the diversion program. She says the support in and out of school helped empower her to make different choices.
I've had a couple bad ideas while being in the diversion program, but because of like the things that they told me, I didn't do it and just went along with my day.
Laurel says that last time her friends invited her to drink and do graffiti, she told them she had to stay home and do chores. And a couple of them showed up at her house to help her clean. She's realized that kids will do just about anything for companionship.
We don't need to spray paint buildings to talk about boys. We need some popcorn.
And she didn't need juvenile detention to figure that out. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
Thank you.
It's no secret that water is a problem in the West. Historically, the humble beaver helped maintain wetlands and ponds across the arid landscape. But their populations were decimated during the fur trade, and their numbers dropped dramatically from 400 million just to 100,000 by the turn of the century. Now, Canada's national animal is making a comeback, and scientists think they have an important role to play as our region fights drought. Maggie Mullen from Wyoming Public Radio has more.
To many ranchers and landowners out here, the beaver is a destructive little beast. Not only can it wreak havoc on irrigation systems, it can take down trees, nibble through fiber optic internet cables, and cause the occasional flood. But if you ask Jeremy Maestas, he says there's much more to the animal, and today he's teaching a workshop on the architectural genius of the beaver.
Just through their diligence and 24-hour work ethic, they're making amazing things happen in the streams. And because they've been here for millennia, the plants that live here have evolved with their browsing and herbivory.
Maestas is a wildlife biologist, and he says the beaver is essentially a walking, talking ecosystem. And he thinks instead of just using dams to control water, we could also follow the beaver's lead. He calls it a sticks and stones approach.
Rather than diesel fuel and Tonka toys, we just direct the water to move sediment and grow vegetation and do all the good things that we want the ecosystem to do.
One of those good things includes storing more water in the ground. Across the Mountain West, most precipitation comes in the wintertime, but when snow melts, it can often be in a hurry, turning into runoff or rushing down a stream to a bigger river and far away from where it's needed. But if it encounters something like a beaver dam, Maestas says the water gets delayed.
The longer that we can keep that on the landscape, we increase the productivity of those plants and ultimately leads to more drought resilience, right? These sponges fill up with water, and it's like putting money in the piggy bank for those lean times.
Lean times, like when you don't get a lot of snow, or when rising temperatures mean snowmelt happens early and the rush of water comes too soon for peak water demand in the growing season.
But it really isn't until you get down in the mud and you start building these that you understand the process that you're trying to fix.
So this afternoon, about 40 people are getting their toes wet and muddy, building a few of these beaver-like dams on a nature conservancy testing ground in Wyoming. The group mostly includes people from agencies like the Bureau of Land Management and Game and Fish.
I feel like this is a perfect day to try something new.
That's Carissa Bussey. She and the others have spent most of the last day and a half learning what makes a beaver tick. She says on a hot day like this, there's only one thing the world's second largest rodent would do.
We better go make ourselves a cool pool.
They won't have the power of chisel-like teeth, so workshop instructor Joe Wheaton says they'll have to be creative.
Your tools, you'll have shovels, very useful. You'll have buckets. Please don't put the buckets back together without cleaning them first. You'll have loppers, you'll have your hands. Make sure
they've brought some untreated fence posts from town to build the dams, but otherwise they'll have to use supplies from the area just like a beaver would. That means willow branches, sticks, stones, and mud.
Sawed off piece of juniper that we can try to wedge in so that it'll fill the truck.
Water can trickle through, but flows still slow down long enough to soak deep into the ground. Jeremy Maestas says there's another big difference between this and a dam.
We don't want to be constantly coming back in here with human labor and effort trying to keep it alive. So the sooner we can turn it over to Mother Nature to do her job, the better off we're all going to be.
Mother Nature, meaning beavers. Once these human-made dams are established, they'll be reintroducing the animal into the area. Maestas says this won't work everywhere, especially in more urban settings or places where the animal could interfere with infrastructure. But in the right setting,
we're bringing nuisance animals into areas where they're wanted.
That way, he says, maybe beavers can begin to solve the problem of water in the West. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
Ahead, we'll end the show talking to American security consultant Frank Abagnale about fraud. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. If you have seen the Steven Spielberg movie Catch Me If You Can, you are no doubt familiar with the name Frank Abagnale. The former teen con artist is now one of the world's most respected authorities on forgery, embezzlement, and secure documents. He is now a Fraudwatch ambassador for AARP and spoke to me this week in Casper.
Well, there are so many scams. You know, there's the IRS scam, the grandparent scam, the sweepstakes scams. And what I've found amazing even to me is in the 4 years I've been doing this and going to 38 states is that you talk to elderly folks who have lost their life savings, lost their pension, lost their home because they've been defrauded. Everybody who came and said they'd fix their roof and took a huge deposit and never showed up to the guy that basically said got involved in a love thing with the person, they never met them, but eventually they ask them for money and they give them money. So I've always approached crime for the last four decades as looking at education being the most powerful tool. So whether I'm training an FBI agent or I'm training a bank teller or I'm training a CFO of a company or a person that's just a consumer, if I can explain to them, here's the scams, here's how they work, these are the two things that constitute to make the scam work. They have to have these two elements. If you know this, then when you get that phone call or you get that email or you get that letter, you'll know that. The truth is the majority of people are honest. And because they're honest, they don't have a deceptive mind. So if they go over to the phone and it's ringing and they have caller ID and it says Casper Police Department, they believe it is the Casper Police Department because no one told them you can easily manipulate the caller ID. And then they start to tell you all this information about arresting your grandson. They give you his name, the girlfriend's name he was in the car with, what kind of car he was driving, his parents' name, because they collected all of that from social media to give them credibility on the phone. You're convinced that, well, this must be the police department. And he needs to make bail in the next couple of hours. He'll have to spend the weekend in jail. He asks us to call you, not his parents. Well, how do I do that? Well, you can give me a credit card, and we'll put the bail money on that. And I can see why people fall for these things. Unless someone already explained that to them, then they'd say, no, I know about this scam and I know how it works.
So your first advice to probably somebody in that type of situation is don't give your credit card to anybody on the phone.
Well, the first advice is this. Remember that every scam, no matter what the scam is, every scam requires two elements. One, I'm going to have to tell you that you have to give me the money immediately. It has to happen right now. You can't say, well, can I come down and pay it? Can I mail it in? No, you have to give me something right now. And the other scam is that there's always money ahead of time. So there's always, if you want a sweepstake, they tell you, well, there's a minimum money you have to pay to get the sweepstake. Those two things have to be in pleasure. They're asking you either for a credit card number, personal information. So I tell people, look, if you met someone on the internet and you're having a great relationship with them and you speak to them on the phone and all that, that's fine that they're keeping you company and you feel comfortable. But when the day comes and you say to them, hey, look, you know, I've never actually met you. Why don't you come visit me? You only live one state away. Well, you know, I would, but I have to have this operation and it's $30,000 and I don't have the money. And, oh, well, you know, I could loan you the money. The minute money comes in, that's a red flag. And the minute I have to tell you, you have to do it immediately, that's the other red flag. And if you just remember those things, you get yourself away from a lot of scams.
The stuff online and sometimes the emails, I've almost fallen for a couple of these things. What are some of the things you're hearing about that are happening right now that people need to really watch for?
Well, 99% of ransomware comes from a phishing email. What we've seen, though, is that the phishing emails are getting very sophisticated. So, for example, the ones I see would say, hi, Karen. Great having lunch with you today. We need to do that again real soon. I hope you and your husband, Robert, have fun with the kids at Disney World this week while you're away. When you get back, call me and we'll do lunch. By the way, I saw this on YouTube. I thought you'd enjoy it. Here's the link. And what's happening is they're going to social media because she already said her husband's name. She already said they were going to Disney World. She mentioned they were going to lunch together. People say so many things that they put out there in social media that criminals have learned, if I can get all of that information, that gives me so much credibility that you would never question that email. You'd say, well, obviously it must be her. I just left her from lunch. And that's what gets real scary.
I want to ask you about that because I see so many people that go on trips and they post these pictures on Instagram and Facebook. How much are they putting themselves at risk?
Way too much. So I'm not on social media, but if you put your picture on social media and it's a regular type photo of you like it would be in a yearbook or a driver's license, one, I can capture that image of you and then use that image on identification to say that I am you. And two, I can basically track you through software that's available like PitPat and Find a Face that all go back to me taking a picture of you and then finding you on social media. So I always tell people you never want a straight photograph of yourself on Facebook. You want a picture of you and your dog, you and your friends, your arms around a bunch of friends playing soccer. Second, you never want to tell someone on Facebook where you were born and your date of birth, because that's 98% of me stealing your identity. If I know those two things, I'm 98% of taking your identity. So I tell people, never tell anybody those two things on social media.
So you've just scared the hell out of a lot of people listening to us right now.
So hopefully they'll do what a lot of people do. They'll go back and take that off. Yeah.
And so you're saying the way to go is just have some multiple folks in the picture.
Right. And here's another thing. Up until September 1st of this year, in order to freeze your credit, which you should have the right to do, because only you should have the right to who sees your credit, only 8 states allowed you to do that for free. All the other states required a fee. So it was $10 to freeze it, $15 to unfreeze it, $10 to freeze it again. Plus you had 3 credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, TransUnion. Now, September 1st, a federal law has gone into effect on September 1st that all 50 states will allow you to freeze your credit at no fee to you. So I tell people, look, if you're 70 years old, you own your house, you own your cars, you have a few credit cards, you don't need your credit. Freeze your credit so that nobody can see it unless you want them to see it. If you need to go buy a washer and dryer and you want to finance it for 12 months, you release your credit to the appliance store so they can get the credit approved, and then it's frozen again. And that would be the same for a young person. So I would recommend anybody after September 1st just freeze their credit, because the truth is you never gave the credit bureau permission to have your information. You never signed a piece of paper that said, hey, you can keep all this personal data about me, and on top of that, you can sell it for billions of dollars for background checks, credit checks. You never did that. So you should at least have the right to say, look, you might store my data, but you cannot show it to anyone unless I authorize you to show it to someone. And that's the way it should be. You should have control over your own personal information.
How can we prevent folks from hacking us?
You got to be a little smarter today and a little wiser today. A lot of companies, as I tell them every day, if you look at every breach, including Equifax, it happened because somebody in that company did something they weren't supposed to do, or somebody in that company did something, failed to do something they were supposed to do. Hackers do not cause breaches; people do. So in the case of Equifax, they didn't keep up their infrastructure, they didn't fix it because it was that attitude, it can't happen to me, I don't want to spend the money. So these are people having data, personal information about you, but they don't have it protected. And if you do that, then you're just opening the door to hackers. And there are so many doors, hackers just go choose where they want to go.
Frank, how can they get more of your tips? Can they go places online and check it out?
Yes, you can. On the consumer side, AARP has a website, Fraud Watch Network. It's free. You don't have to be an AARP member. They have a toll-free number in case you are a victim or you think you're being victimized, and they'll talk you through it. And, of course, on my website at abingdale.com, I write everything involving embezzlement, check forgery, counterfeiting, identity theft, things that people are concerned about, those on the business side of it.
Frank, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Thanks for catching this edition of Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear the entire show or individual stories and interviews, go to our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
While you're there, be sure to sign up for our podcast. You can also subscribe via Apple Podcasts and wherever you download your podcasts.
We'd love to hear your story ideas, too. You can send us those on our website or via Facebook. Anna Rader is our web editor.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.